session number 9938, reel 1.
Mr. Philpott, reel 1. Where were you born, Mr. Philpott?
I was born in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
What did your father do for a living?
He was an electrical engineer, and he was very much concerned with the electrical energy developments there, particularly helping build a dam in the Fraser River for the British Columbia Electric Company.
What was your education?
I went to three public schools in all, two Canadian ones, which really were public, the second one being the Queen Mary School, North Vancouver, and the third one being when I was brought over as a boy of 12 to England, and after working away at an English prep school, where the first thing I did was to kick the head boy's bottom, I then was rounded off and made a little more civilized by the English, and I entered Radley College.
And where did you go to after school, as far as your education was concerned? Where did you go to after school? Did you go to university?
Oh, after school. Yes, yes. I'm sorry, I missed it. Yes, yes. I went to Worcester College, Oxford.
To read what?
To read PPE, philosophy, politics, and economics.
And you left in which year?
I left in 1934.
To do what?
I then joined Unilever as a senior trainee, management trainee.
So how did you become interested in aircraft?
Well, I was always rather interested in aircraft. For instance, one of my cousins married Henry Milnes, who won a military cross in the Kaiser's War. And I remember him telling me that on one of his reconnaissance trips over enemy territory, he saw a train slipping away into the distance. And unfortunately, he was running short of petrol and had to get back. And it was only later that he heard that it was the Kaiser's train, and it slipped away into the depth of Germany. Airplanes always interested me, and I remember in 1928 going up to Wirksworth in Derbyshire, where I had cousins, and we saw an RAF biplane that had come down and went right over on its back. And we all examined this and took photos of it. Later in that year, a year or two later, I remember sitting in Kintbury in Berkshire, where I lived, and we heard the news on a foul night that R101, the great airship which we had crashed at Beauvais. At Radley College, which, as you know, is near Abingdon, Berkshire, we have a vast cricket pitch, also used for rugger and other sports, and we're all in the OTC, the Officers Training Corps, in khaki, 400 boys, and we'd march up and down in 8 different platoons there. It was one of these very English things, which was voluntary but compulsory. And I remember we were told an RAF fighter was going to land there one day, and all the boys were herded to one side of this huge pitch. And when it came down, we managed to avoid getting into the way of its propellers and stared at this biplane fighter. One day, we were told we were going to be taken, a party of us were going to be taken in a in a bus to Upper Hayford in Oxfordshire. And we then were taken up in a Vickers Vimy bomber, big black thing, which to us was absolutely vast, and it had two large engines on each side, biplane, like all planes were there. Monoplanes were not popular. I remember standing on the open platform out in front, like a sort of veranda, and holding on to the railing there, and the wind in our faces and blowing our cameras about. And we saw the Oxfordshire countryside from there. Then there was, as I mentioned earlier, Worcester College, Oxford. And we're talking war, aren't we, really? And I'd been to see a presentation of Journey's End by R.C. Sheriff. And I found what was said about the trenches highly unattractive. And about the same time, I regularly got a Sunday paper which showed some quite amazing photos taken in the 1418 war by the Royal Flying Corps people. And showing aircraft fighting one another, aircraft breaking up, pilots falling out without parachutes, etc., etc. All very frightening, but I thought that with a probable war coming up again, which I thought highly likely, I thought that a preferable way of occupying oneself and doing one's stuff for the country to trenches. And I, my interest in aeroplanes was strengthened by that. To get into the Oxford University Air Squadron, one had to be vetted by some OUAS people, and also the dean of my college, the redoubtable Colonel C.H. Wilkinson of the Guards.
What was the nature of this vetting?
To see whether we just wanted free rides or whether we were likely to do the country some good if the balloon went up. And I remember Wilkinson saying, "Do you think there'll be going to be another war?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And that was about it. And in November 1931, I was accepted. They were also looking to see whether, as I've already mentioned, that we would really put our minds to this flying, because there's a lot of pacifism about just then, and Labour had just experienced the feel of power. And the authorities in at that time, were very anxious not to be violently militaristic, so that we got blazers for the Oxford University Air Squadron. We were allowed to buy those with an RAF crest on the pocket, a pocket badge rather, but we couldn't have RAF buttons, for instance. We just got ordinary buttons, which shows the sort of anxieties of the squadron of the authorities of the day. I remember training in Upper Hayford. We'd go out there in one of these lorries, which always stank of petrol, and these open things. And I remember Abingdon being opened up for the first time, which is now a well-known aerodrome, which everybody assumes has been there for more or less ever, I think. We used to go in the Oxford University Air Squadron every year to a camp, a two-week camp at Eastchurch, and you can't get much more traditional with the flying services than East Church in the Isle of Sheppey. And one did mock force landings, because in those days it was always assumed that your aircraft was more or less bound to have its engine give out or get temperamental in one way or another, and you were always trained wherever you flew to spot a forced landing field, a suitable field. And there was one there, I remember, at a place called Laysdown. It was a luxurious camp because for the Oxford University Air Squadron members, we were really given the works as regards being looked after. Batman drew one's bath, laid out one's dinner jacket when all the flying is over in the day. And we got for, I'd emphasize, a very temporary period, really, in my life, a very luxurious time. We had a very luxurious time. We flew in the mornings at East Church at about 6:30 a.m. And I was extremely slow in going solo. I mean, princesses are much better at it than now, much quicker. I took no less than 27 hours to go solo, so you can't really call me a natural airman. But what a pleasure it was not to have the voice of the instructor or instructors one after another telling one's faults all the time and being up there on one's own. And the first one was, of course, an Avro 504K. This had bamboo skids placed underneath the end of each wing, because with that airplane you had to land it into wind. It was no good landing it 10 or 15 degrees out of the wind. And of course all the aerodromes were grass aerodromes, and if you landed it slightly out of the winds, one wing would more or less do its best to dig its wingtip into the aerodrome, and you go around a very undignified circle, and with any luck it'd come straight again, because the curved bamboo prevented the wing tip actually digging into the grass and breaking the wing, which are all very fabric covered wings and so on. They weren't great metal things as they are now. We did all sorts of things in the Avro 504K. It was a good aerobatic machine. I think what thing that really rather horrified some of the onlookers was to do a falling leaf in which you stall the aircraft, and when you do that, having held the nose up and throttled back, you fall over to one side. And then you get into a spin, which is well enough known. For the falling leaf, just as you're falling over, say, to the left-hand side, you push the control column over the other side and jerk it over to fall the other side. And the result is you fall downwards, tail first. And it looks quite sensational. I think the RAF authorities weren't very much in favor of it, but plenty of the instructors did it, and they taught one how to do this. Blind flying, of course, in those days, that just wasn't known, and was considered rather an extraordinary concept. But we got started in Abingdon Aerodrome with a hood being fixed to an Avro 504K, and the wind flapping around, and you have to look at your fairly primitive but perfectly efficient and sufficient instruments, and as you know, for blind flying, to crush down all your instincts, all your feeling for flying. You think you're going to the left, really you're going down to the right, and you think you're going up to the left, and so on. And my instructor there was the imperturbable Murray, who is a magnificent man and calm as anything. And his voice just saying, well, now you're diving rather fast, aren't you? And you'd put it right. I later came across him as the adjutant of the East Compound in Stalag III. He's known as Wank Murray, and he's still imperturbable there in coping with our enemies who had captured us. I graduated from the Avro 504 to a machine called an Atlas, an Armstrong Whitworth Atlas, with no less than a 575 horsepower radial Jaguar engine. This is a great fat aircraft, one engine, as I've indicated, and it is considered, it is an army reconnaissance aircraft, and it was considered a fast machine as regards landing. You had to land at 70, which was a high speed in those days. And what you had to remember with the Atlas was that you had at all costs to avoid a flat gliding turn. If you're going to do a gliding turn, keep that nose down and keep your speed up. But don't do a flat gliding turn, get slower and slower, because the Atlas would then turn right over and head for the earth. And I remember there was one occasion when I went out to fly, and there's a little heap of an Atlas out in on the aerodrome there, and made somewhat anxious inquiries. The chap had got out all right, but one aircraft was written off. The Atlas was quite a good aircraft in its way, but it is curiously difficult to do a slow roll to the left. We had at Worcester College, Oxford, a fine old Victorian provost called Jackie Liss, L-Y-S, a true old Victorian. He, like so many Victorians, which they're not given credit for these days, I think, was anxious to try everything. And he knew some of his undergraduates were in the OUAS. And cut a long story short, he was given a ride by the RAF, who showed their imagination, in an Atlas aircraft. And they took him over Oxford and over Worcester College and so on. But it was an absolute tragedy because some clot of a man at the aerodrome left the seat adjusted down and hadn't wound it up higher up, so he couldn't really see. He's a very short man, and one doubted whether he actually saw his college or not. From an Avro Atlas, one graduated to an Avro Tutor, which is a beautiful little biplane, all biplanes, as I've said, a beautiful little airplane. And I remember going over in a formation led by Wing Commander Keith Park, who was later AOC of 11 Group in the south of England there, key man in the Battle of Britain. We went in this little formation of tutors to see Sir Philip Sassoon in Hampshire. The Avro Tutor was a really reliable little airplane, and on my last flight, I decided to do a bunt, which I seem to remember was forbidden, and I clambered up over Eastchurch by myself, to about 8,500 feet, and clambered up there, and then did an inverted glide with the wheels up towards the sky, and then stalled it upside down. One had been warned that this could be adventurous, and it certainly was, and I remember a great swoosh as it hurtled down in a great slow circle and it seemed almost an instant. I'd lost 1,500 feet. And then I righted the aircraft, which I've been taught to do in any situation, and came down again. The ground crew were not very happy with me because a lot of the oil came out and smeared the aircraft. But I felt that I must do that last aerobat. In the Oxford University Air Squadron, the aristocrats of the Oxford University Air Squadron were very nice chaps, but you could call them that, were the Honourable John Grimston, who, for instance, bought one of the surplus Bristol fighters that the RAF was selling off at the time, £500 each. And Sir Archibald Hope was another member who also bought a Bristol fighter for £500 and flew it about in places where they lived and had space in the fields to land. The third one that comes to mind was, I think he was called Whitehead, but anyhow, he was a man who actually owned a puss moth, a little cabin moth, and he did daring things because distances were very different in those days, and would fly to Italy and back, and oh, I was thrilled at that. In 1934, in a flying competition, I managed, in the Oxford University Air Squadron, I managed to come in fourth, which is something. We had, I've touched on it already a little bit, outstanding wing commanders in the squadron. I just missed Garrod, who became pretty well known. I was under Wing Commander Roderick Hill, who was later the Air Member for Technical Matters. I've mentioned Keith Park already. Yes, Keith Park. He was 11 Group and so on in the Battle of Britain. And it's related of him that with Churchill at his side at a crucial point in that battle, Churchill said, watching interceptions of German bombers coming here, and all marked up in the operations board, Churchill said to him, well, Commander, when are you putting up your reserves? And Keith Park, it is said, turned to him and said, our last reserves are already in the air. You've just seen the notification of them taking off. Keith Park was really a war winner type, and later he went off to Malta and helped save Malta, which the Luftwaffe were pulverizing all the time. And Lord Gort, who I think was in charge of Malta at the time, tried to prevent him having a party for the Air Force, saying it was dangerous grouping them all together. But Keith Park knew something about morale, and he had the party. Different characters they were, Hill and Park. Hill was a natural pilot, and to illustrate airmanship, he would draw a picture on a board of horsemanship, beautiful pictures of people coping with a horse and reining it back and so on. That is his instinct. And Park was a mechanical but supremely accurate pilot, but almost on occasions in a jerky way. And when he would come down after a flight, we would see from the flight office at Abingdon, he would come up to close to the hangar and then turn it round, turn the aircraft round, roaring up the engine at the end and blowing dust over everybody. Both of these wing commanders, as they were then, would, if they were giving you a practice flight and examining and criticizing your flying, they would say at the end of the flight, They would say, I've got her now. And they would approach below hangar level with the hangar coming up on the left-hand side and some trees on the right and over a petrol storage dump and land the aircraft, in this case Avro Tudor I'm thinking of, very, very close to the hangar it was meant to go in a frightfully neat and brilliant way. My regular instructor had been a flight lieutenant in those days, F.J. Mellersh, M-E-L-L-E-R-S-H, and we had faithful men teaching us what airplanes needed doing to them on the ground, called Devereux and Aitken, very nice ground crewmen and very tolerant of us mad undergraduates. Must have driven them daft from time to time, I should think. Mellersh told me once, when I pressed him to say, talk about his war in the Royal Flying Corps, 1418, that he had chased Richthofen and was getting very close to Richthofen on what turned out to be Richthofen's last flight, because he was hit by fire from the trenches. And Mellersh, close behind, landed. It's amazing how you could nip around up and down from the ground, landing and taking off in these biplanes. He landed very close to where Richthofen had come down in a sort of crash landing, but not an entire mess. And he was the first to rush up. He left his aircraft, and he was the first to rush up and peer into the cockpit and to see if Richthofen was dead, and he was dead. Now, on August 28th, 1934, a date I happen to remember, I joined Unilever as a management trainee, which I think I've touched on earlier, and was greeted at the testing stage by Francis Darcy Cooper, the first chairman of Unilever. And he's a large man. He stood up in his chairman's place in that horseshoe table Unilever have, and he stood up to greet me, a mere shrimp of a management trainee, just having packed up as an undergraduate and getting out into the commercial world. Vandenbergs and Jurgens, sales of Stork Margarine, J.P. Vandenberg was my boss, and so on. Part of the training was very thorough, and one nipped about everywhere. And in 1936, which has a relevance to this war thing, I was packed out to the Margarine Verkaufsunion, the Margarine Sales Union, which was part of Unilever in Berlin. And I had to live somewhere, so I was fixed up. I managed to fix myself up in Berlin Grunewald, Douglas Strasse 11, Douglas Street 11.